Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Technology Leaders.
Lee Cantor here with James Douglas of Bandicoders, and it's another exciting episode of Atlanta Technology Leaders. And James, what is your favorite part about doing the show?
I think it's just hearing some of the amazing stories of what's happening so locally. There's some amazing people doing some incredible things, and just having the chance to hear a little bit about it in a small segment.
Walking the talk, basically I share with them that we are a global nonprofit focused on mobile wireless services, or now leveraging what we call MBAS, Mobile Backend as a Service, which is basically mobile cloud, to accelerate startups in order to be successful and introduce them to with different business models and revenue models for them to be able to be successful.
Now, you've been around Atlanta for a little bit, huh?
Yes, sir.
Where'd you start off in Atlanta? What were you doing?
Actually, it started with Southern Bell.
Southern Bell.
Southern Bell.
I don't know. I know there's some young people in this room that probably don't remember Southern Bell.
Southern Bell became...
You might have to tell me.
Southern Bell became Bell South, and I worked at a lab, just like an AT&T lab. Mm. At that time, the hot technology were... X25, X75, and then came into frame relay, SMDS. So that, at that time, that's what was the top technology. We still use frame relay, but it goes way back then.
So now, how did Mobile Monday come about?
Well, Mobile Monday originated in Finland. And at that particular time when I was involved, I still continue to do business development worldwide. So I was happened to be in St. Petersburg, Russia, and someone mentioned to me, you're in USA. We have no one there. We'd like to know if you can help us grow the Mobile Monday. So I'm actually one of the co-founders of the original Mobile Monday, which is now 140 cities, 50 countries.
And then so you came here to Atlanta. Was it well received?
No. We still think that others view us as competitors, and that's the reason our business model is no charge. So they know that. No, we're not here to. So that's what
that
we're
makes
doing.
It clear, right? You're not competing with anybody. You want to be everybody's friend, right?
Exactly. So the person that's now head in Digital Georgia, North Georgia, and yesterday he was at Middle Georgia, Bill Price. He introduced me to GSMA, and then we started back then, and Mobile Monday. Up to maybe 2 years ago, was the only one feature at Mobile World Congress in Barcelona, which, as you know, is the world's largest convention. Now they have others, but that was the relationship that we have. And Bill Price, is a great friend. He's doing some excellent things, and we're backing him and supporting him.
Do you have other partners?
Oh yes. We also partner with a number of accelerators worldwide. We're working with Startup Nation. If you look them up, they're in 100 nations. they're part of the Coffin Foundation. And then we also team up with other similar labs that accelerate and virtually incubate startups. The one that we're working with right now very closely, they're in the Americas, but they happen to have one of their labs in Mexico City, which was funded by the government, and Google Ventures there, many other global investors are there. And so both labs are connected, and I'm the a mentor, in their labs. There's a number of amazing startups in Argentina and also in Brazil. So now what we're actually doing, it'd be a surprise and something that the economic development officials would like. We create a soft landing for disruptive revenue generating startups. And so to be able to bring startups right here into greater Atlanta is something that people will want and what we want to do.
So now you're working with economic development people? And you're pointing to one right now, right? He's another one of our guests here. Randall Toussaint, is that right?
That's correct.
Now you're here from, where are you, Cumming?
Yeah, from Cumming, Georgia, where we're at the Cumming Forsyth County Chamber of Commerce.
And then, so how'd you find Ed?
The funny thing about Ed is if you're looking...
He finds you, right?
Yeah, right. It's kind of like he just pops up and there's the resources. But Ed's been a great partner. We've, for quite some time in Forsyth County, have been experiencing a tremendous amount of growth And we've started to see industries really come back after the downturn. And we were trying to figure out how we can start to focus more on our technology sector. I think Forbes pegs us now as the 7th fastest growing community in America, and I think we're the 13th wealthiest as well. So for us, that was a key sector that we want to try to attract more companies towards and then help them grow and expand once they land it.
So now, as part of the Coming Foresight Chamber, is that affiliated with the Alpharetta Chamber as well, or you guys are all working together?
Well, it's a partnership. We're actually, our Chamber of Commerce represents the jurisdictions of Forsyth County and the municipality of the city of Cumming. But in terms of economic development, we do partner very closely with all of our neighboring communities and their economic development teams.
So now how do you work with Ed, or how does what you do kind of work with Ed's work as with the incubators and the startups and all that?
Well, it's an interesting thing. We in Forsyth had for quite some time really been anchored in terms of technology through our data centers. We're the homes of the data centers for UPS, New York Life, JM Family, which is the outsourced data side of Toyota, and then also Publix's data center. But we had really started to look at what's happened since the economic downturn and how we were beginning to see many folks who previously had senior level positions within major technology firms begin to take on a sense of entrepreneurialism. And they really started focusing on startups. And it's grown throughout all of North Georgia. In years prior, we used to have folks coming out of technical colleges who were developing these phenomenal platforms for technology and software. And now it's kind of shifted it from the garage to the upstairs bedroom in the suburbs where these companies are emerging. So we want to create a platform where we could just bring everyone together and get them out of the bedrooms and just let them meet each other. And Ed actually came to us with the opportunity to partner up and offer some of these companies just, as he said, a soft landing pad so that way after they develop their products, they could look to grow.
And then you're working with a lot of the big companies. I guess it's kind of a secret, and maybe not for you guys, but for the metro area, that there's so much technology up that far north.
That's true. Well, it's the funny thing. We don't look at it as that far north. You don't need a passport to get up there.
You know, but for some people, once you get outside the perimeter, you know.
That's true.
Go ahead. No, you go.
An interesting thing, too, we've in the last year or so had a merger between North Georgia College and State University and then also Gainesville, their college. And it's created what's now the University of North Georgia. And they have just been a catalyst to help push the sense of entrepreneurialism in our area.
And that's important to be able to partner with universities, right, to create that kind of ecosystem where entrepreneurialism thrives?
Absolutely. Without really that partnership between the public sector, the private sector, and the educational side, you really can't have an ecosystem of innovation. And that's really what we're trying to strive for.
And that's why you were looking at Ruben, right?
That's correct.
Ruben Bowling, welcome.
Good to be here.
Now, why don't you share what you do and how you play a part in this?
Well, I'm director of the Center for the Future of North Georgia, which is in the Mike Cottrell College of Business at the University of North Georgia, which is a mouthful when you try to tell everybody where you work. But it is focused primarily on economic development and entrepreneurship out of the center. And we work with our community in the Northeast Georgia, including the Cumming and Forsyth Chamber of Commerce. And really, when you look at it, we have the opportunity to capture young minds and get them ready for being entrepreneurial as they move out and create their own businesses, or even when they go to work for a large business, being entrepreneurially minded, that they'll be more successful in growing and helping those companies as they move forward. And from a technology space, you know, there's a lot going on. And as these new companies are locating here, one of the things they're looking for is talent. And what we're trying to do is to make sure that when we graduate a student, we have strong graduates that can build strong communities. And so when we do that, we try to make sure that they understand business and have all the knowledge behind that, but have the drive and the understanding to be proactive and be innovative and be willing to take a little risk when they move out.
Now, I remember a few years ago, I was at my nephew's graduation at a Georgia college, not yours, And I guess the dean was talking about it, and he wasn't talking about entrepreneurship at all. He was focused on get a job, and this will prepare you for getting a job. And it seemed that that time the mindset was you go to college to get a job somewhere. It seems what you're saying is kind of you have to be open to being an entrepreneur, and that's a different message. And are you finding the students open to that message?
We are. We now have a group of students that we meet with every other week that just are just talking through ideas that they have for new businesses and what they might be able to do. And that's growing. We have not only technology folks, our students, but those that are marketing and management majors. And I just recently started talking with some folks in other areas of the university where you have even healthcare and arts-related folks that are also in the same shape. You know, they're not going necessarily to work for large organizations. They're opening their own place. We have a very strong physical therapy school there at the University of North Georgia, and a lot of those go out and become managers real quick or to even start their own firm. So it's business-oriented, but at the same time, it's across the university. And you see that nationwide, that universities are really pushing that entrepreneurial mindset to the full university, not just holding it in the business school.
And it's critical because, I mean, when I went to university back in the day, we went and did quite a few classes on entrepreneurship. And I think irrespective of whether you do it as a career, that understanding of things can always change, things can always be better, and it's about bringing people together to solve a problem is something that's common for anyone in any industry, and it's such a vital skill.
Yeah, and really when you look at technology, what I see is it's enabling people to I don't know how to say this, but to open the black box and look inside. And a lot of the things that we have done in the past that people didn't quite understand, that they just threw in that big black box, is being opened up and fragmented to the point to where, you know, there's opportunities to identify gaps that you can fill with different applications as we move forward. We see that just in the growth in apps by itself.
Mm. So. Actually, Ruben and I were speaking earlier, and that's when we met. We have a program called Grads to Grow, or Student Fertilization, that does just that. And what I was sharing with Ruben is that we're reaching out to Home Depot, the chairman, and also the president, to create what we call the 180 pitch. Normally, you know, startups will pitch to investors, but this is different, where hardware companies or retail companies will think about a specific product they would like to build because they know it'll be successful, and then they will do the pitch to the grads, the startups, the students, and then it will be a challenge, and then those that meet those challenges, you know, they will be rewarded, and then they can launch their product.
So it's where the enterprise is kind of partnering with the entrepreneurs
and universities
and the universities. So. Are you finding that you mentioned Home Depot, but is that something that the other large firms around town are embracing?
We're looking to do just that. We already have the okay from Auto Trader, so Mark Acosta already says yes. So we want to add more and more. So hopefully, you know, we can continue to grow.
Now, Randall, how do you kind of foster that environment? Are you who's like the point guard here that's kind of putting all these people together?
My role within the organization that we're in the chamber is just that. I get to be the facilitator. And what's unique about that is we're now at a point, I think, coming out of the economic downturn where more people want to step up to the table to offer resources. Mm-hmm. We all have the common goal, really, of just stimulating Georgia's economy. Mm-hmm. And our goal in doing what we're doing in terms of our forums and our platforms, really, it's twofold. It's first to recognize what the immediate needs are of our local businesses and the business communities that we're trying to foster, including the small business and startup sectors and technology sectors, but then to develop toolkits full of resources that can respond to those needs and respond rapidly.
Now, Ed, do you find that the metro Atlanta area is kind of unique in the world in the sense of collaboration that occurs, that they don't look at a business doesn't look at things as a zero-sum game where your gain is my loss, that they're willing to work together and collaborate?
I'm seeing that now, and I'm very encouraged, and I like it. That's the reason. Something that we're doing, we want to do it also. We will do it in coming. So January 15th, we begin to meet at the at ATV for a reason to bring in startups. And then we're also going to lease, you know, in the first quarter, space to provide a no charge to disruptive innovators. And we want to do this in Greater Atlanta. We want to do it in coming.
And were you aware of that, Randall, or did Ed just surprise you?
Ed just keeps bringing more surprises. No, I'm joking. We talked about it, and we're excited. We have started a small little get-together that's grown tremendously called the North Atlanta Startup Coffee. And essentially, it's just an opportunity for startups, techies, creatives, and innovators to meet and get to know each other, to kind of come out of the upstairs bedroom, share ideas, and learn. And we held our first one last month. We had about 30 folks that came out. Great event, and we're looking to do the next one on November 5th. And we look forward to partnering with Ed and with the university as well.
Right.
So now, Ruben, how do you contribute to that event? Do you just get the word out amongst your students to let them know that the event's happening? What are you guys doing to help?
I get the word out, but not only to students. I get to be around the whole community. So I'm out and about quite a bit from that standpoint. Randall and I are good partners in a lot of things that we do together to try to build business. And in addition to that, the coming Forsyth Chamber of Commerce and the University of North Georgia, both partners are members of the Greater Alpharetta Technology Network, which covers North Fulton as well as Forsyth and Hall counties and those areas, so that you can come together and network with technology folks. And you get not only startups, but you get those established businesses. And so they get to talk with each other and interact, and you see growth in both of those areas. And the next one of those, I'll go ahead and plug for that. The next one of those is also November 5th in the evening. It starts at 5:30 at the brand new Avalon.
Now, how does maybe you can share some insight for the companies that may want to work with a university? What are some ways that an enterprise, a larger company, can reach out to the university and kind of work with you guys for the betterment of both parties?
Well, there's many ways. I talk with companies on a regular basis who call up and say, "Hey, I want to connect with you guys. How do I do that?" And I say, "Well, let's determine how you want to connect first and what you want to get out of it." And we kind of develop a good partnership so that both sides can benefit from that. From either interns, we place a lot of interns in different companies throughout the area, and we've been very, very successful in that. Also recruiting our graduates for jobs, and in addition to that, we put on several events that that help with the education and the knowledge within the community as well. Some of the leaders speaker series and things like that that we connect with them from that standpoint.
Now, is there ever the opportunity where the enterprise says, "You know what, we need more people that have these skills," and they kind of lean on you from a curriculum standpoint to say, "Hey, can you beef up this department?"
Well, yes, changing curriculum is something that takes a while in consideration from that. So it's not as fast moving.
Right, you can't
as
just flip a switch. But yeah. But that I would just wanted to know if you guys work together at that level where, like, "Hey, we need more people with these skills." I mean, we have to get them from somewhere.
Well, one of the things that we just completed, we went around the region holding workshops that we brought in businesses from the region, and we asked them, said, "What are you looking for in our graduates?"
Right.
Many of those things included professional development kind of things. In other words, don't just prepare them academically,
right,
which we do a good job of, but prepare them professionally so when they come, they're ready to be successful. And that's the way we look at it. You talked about getting a job. Academically, if we prepare them academically, we can get them a job. But then how successful will they be once they start that job? And we do that through, again, helping them from a professional standpoint. And the last thing that we're trying to do, which goes along with what we're talking with today, is we really want to have our students be entrepreneurially minded. And that, and just about every company we talked about, that was the, that was what they mentioned in their request, was that we have students that can critically think, can evaluate problems, and find solutions, which is really gets down to being entrepreneurially minded.
Randall, were you wanting to say something about that?
Well, just to dovetail a little on what Ruben had mentioned, and to give the university a plug, recently we shared with the university that we were recognizing that many of our German companies who are located in Forsyth County,
right,
and there's over about 70 international firms within Forsyth, with the largest concentration being from Germany. They had shared with us that they had arrived in the metro Atlanta area initially as startups, small businesses that had moved to our area to open and branch out in the U.S. market. And they were finding it challenging, as were many companies throughout the nation, actually, to recognize how to identify technically trained workers. And in their thought pattern, they recognized there was a skills gap, and they wanted to figure out how to address it. And we went to the university and mentioned this to Ruben in the Center of for the Future of North Georgia. And they were gracious enough to reach out to other communities in the area and ask, are you seeing the same thing?
Right.
And they pulled together a forum that consisted of the majority, really, of all German companies within North Metro Atlanta. And from that, they were able to develop some patterns or recognize some patterns that had worked overseas that we could actually implement here, including entrepreneurial style apprenticeships, which were phenomenal. And they recently partnered with the Chamber to visit Germany and meet with some of the companies that they had spoken to here, but their affiliate offices overseas, and learn how those partnerships were developed and learn how to implement the apprenticeships, but with the U.S. model.
Now, Ed, with your global background, how do you fit into this?
Well, in several ways. I want to add to the comment regarding how is it, what other programs will be introduced into universities. I'm going to say this, and then I'll give you the actual person to speak with. So you know, there's a very large you know, a mindset that America needs to increase their cybersecurity awareness and expertise. So this was announced several times. So they have selected a Fort Gordon Battle Lab as the cyber core lab for private and public. And very soon it'll be announced. And then one of the things that they did identify that they need individuals that are expertise. And they are going to create an academic curriculum to do just that. You know, so this is another opportunity for university want to become involved. So they, I'm part of it, and I'll let you know on the private side how is that I'm part of it for as we create a private security cloud. You know, to be able to protect American enterprises, but that will be offline.
Good stuff. Well, it seems like a lot of exciting stuff is happening up in North Georgia. And Randall, what is on your wish list of things you need more of?
We need more Ed. I mean, just to start, that's a great starting point. But in all honesty, really, if we can develop more of these partnerships, if we can recognize where there's resource providers who can come to the table, I think that will offer a wider array of opportunities for growth for both technology startups as well as for innovation to take place within our area.
And just for anyone that's listening, when you say extra resources or those that can bring them, what specifically, if someone's listening, that would help identify themselves?
Well, I think we often think about access to capital as being one of the main criteria that most startups are looking for. But I think coming out of the downturn, there's also a sense of need for business development resources as well. The essential core competencies of being able to create business plans or develop market strategies or find fundamental research, I think now more than ever, we're at a point where if resource providers are able to come to the table, it can help creatives who have been phenomenal at developing a product figure out how to implement strategies to get that product to market faster.
Now, what's been the most rewarding thing for you personally being involved in this exciting scene up there?
Honestly, it's seeing the growth, especially as it relates to jobs and capital investment. You know, growing up, some kids want to be firefighters, some kids want to be astronauts. This is all I have ever wanted to do. And I think we're at a point in human history where everyone understands the value of new jobs and new capital investment coming to a community. And this project, being able to work with folks like Ruben and Ed, it's been incredible because the outcome of what we're working on is going to be new companies that are going to be able to help our economy.
Now, if somebody wanted to learn more about the North Atlanta startup scene, where should they go?
I think each of us will probably share a little bit of information on the chamber side. You can visit our website at www.comingforsythchamber.org. And there's an events page that has our upcoming technology startup events as well.
Now, Ruben, I want to ask you the same question I asked Randall. What do you need more of? Just more passionate students?
Well, we're growing quite significantly, so I'm not sure how how fast more we want students. But we do want good students to move forward. But really, just like Randall talked about, partnerships is what we need. We need partnerships with companies within the region. We need partnerships with people like Ed and Randall to really assist our students. We love being able to bring people into the classroom even to speak with students and give them a live understanding of what it's like, kind of the application of the stuff that they're learning.
Right, so it gets out of the theoretical and it gets into the real life.
Right, right. And we like to get them out into the field in internships just job experiences in some way so that, again, as they graduate, they get a job, but then they understand how to be successful.
Right.
And that's really what is going to drive our region as we move forward. You can find out, just like Randall said, you can find out more on our website at the University of North Georgia. It is ung.edu, and you can do /CFNG, and you'll get to Center for the Future of North Georgia, and you'll see some of the activities that we have going on there and who to contact in order to find out more about it.
So you're bullish about North Georgia?
Bullish. I am more than bullish. We have a great university. We produce some of the best students around. A lot of people don't know we're also one of 6 senior military colleges in the U.S. 10% of our students are Army cadets, which really brings a new atmosphere to the university, one of collegiality, one of respect, those kind of things. So we put out some graduates that are good. Everybody I talk with just brags on them all the time.
So leadership isn't an issue over there.
We still try our best to make sure that we build that into every curriculum that we do. Because as you were young and I was young, we still need to be reminded.
And Ed, what's the best way people want to get a hold of you?
MumbleMondayATL.com or MumbleMondayATL@gmail.com.
And you're going to keep helping these guys grow and help be the matchmaker?
Well, I feel privileged and honored to be working with them.
All right. Well, appreciate you three being part of the show. We got one more guest, Praveen Ganta. Welcome.
Thank you.
Did you learn anything from these guys? Do you know all that activity was going on up there?
Well, yeah, no, it's definitely interesting to hear about what's going on in North Georgia. We actually... our most recent hire at my company, Hidden Levers, was he's from Dahlonega, and I believe he took some classes at University of North Georgia. But he's a UX designer, so he works on the front end of our product. So a little bit of a connection there. Still, I hadn't realized that Cumming and Forsyth and in that area that so much was going on technology wise. I think the metro area it can be so spread out in some ways that there's pockets all over, and so the challenge is certainly to bring it all together and get everybody on the same page.
So now you're with Hidden Levers. Can you share a little bit about what you guys are doing for folks?
Sure. My company is called Hidden Levers. I'm one of the co-founders, and what we do is portfolio stress testing. So we help financial advisors, that's our client base, financial advisors and investment advisors, we help them answer questions from their clients, from their end investors, what if questions, like what would happen to my portfolio if Europe goes into recession? What might happen to my portfolio as we see the Federal Reserve starting to step back and no longer do the quantitative easing and the other programs that we hear about? You know, maybe interest rates are going to maybe rise over the next year. What happens to my portfolio based on all of those changes in the economy? So we provide tools to investment advisors to help them model out and forecast or at least to run different scenarios and look at how portfolios react to different situations.
Is this your first startup, or you've been around the block a couple times?
A few times. This is my third startup. I actually came out of school in 99, so right into the heart of dot-com era one, I guess you could say, and got swept up in it, quit my first day job after 6 months, and started a company that was acquired 8 or 9 months thereafter, and rode the dot-com wave up and then down to the crash. And I think when I sold my shares, I went and had a nice dinner with the money. So, that was the roller coaster experience of those times. In a lot of ways, I felt like it was a good launching point for my career, and I definitely learned a lot from that experience. But at the same time, what we've been working on now over the last several years with Hidden Levers, it's been much more organic. And I think... Now, that previous experience I alluded to was in the Boston area, and actually later, and after that, New York. With Hidden Levers, my current startup, my co-founder is located in New York. You know, being a finance industry-oriented startup, there's an advantage to having that. But the majority of our employees are here in Atlanta, and I feel like startups in this area are much more organic in how they're built. As a company, we haven't raised any capital or bootstrapped, and we're profitable and growing profitably. And so in some sense, we're really just another small business. You know, we might apply the label startup, and we certainly are trying to grow at that high growth rate trajectory like other startups are. But it's a little different from maybe the absolutely venture-based kind of reality that you see maybe out west. And I feel like in the Atlanta community, we see a lot of companies that are growing along those lines as well.
So now when you're doing your customer discovery period, how open are these financial firms to kind of a new idea like this?
Well, that's a good question. In a sense, because, you know, oftentimes the financial industry can be risk averse and new ideas, there's certainly risks involved in managing large amounts of money, without a doubt. We started out for that reason. The first client base that sort of became attracted to what we do are independent financial advisors. So these are folks who maybe they worked at the Merrill Lynch's and J.P. Morgan's and other large firms out there, and they've gone out and taken their clients and gone independent. And this is sort of a growing trend in the investment industry that you have investment advisors that form their own offices and bring their clients with them. And these folks, once they leave the big mothership, if you will, they don't have access to the tools that they had previously. So they are, in effect, small businesses looking to go out and acquire technology. We kind of fit into that picture being a cloud-based piece of technology that they can plug right in to get access to our risk analytics and the risk management that we provide. And so that was really the first customer base that responded positively, and we've sort of grown upward from there. And the funny thing is, and even our clients sort of realize this, at the big firms, they don't necessarily have what we provide either. But if, as a startup, we were to go to I actually worked at Deutsche Bank in a previous life, and if I were to go, and we actually did pitch Deutsche Bank Americas, and you know you can have a very positive reception, and at the same time get told, if you try to just finish this process start to finish and actually get in the door here, you'll go out of business before you finally get the okay. You know, that's the nature of working with
just because
with
it's so slow moving.
Yeah, just because
to make a decision.
I mean, the sales cycle might be 18 to 24 months when you're coming out of the gate, but also the vetting process that you would go through to assess your firm's viability. Well, guess what? It's me and my co-founder. Where's the viability? So that's not a risk that the enterprise is necessarily willing to take. So for us, the organic sort of finding these independent investment advisors and going to the conferences that they meet at and kind of building from there, that enabled us to establish a reputation in the industry. And now we're starting to see the larger companies come around and look at what we have to offer.
So can you share with our listeners that first conversation with the first firm that, you know, gave you guys a shot?
Sure. I have to think back now. It was really, interestingly, we came to market with our solution, and we knew all along that, we're building this model that enables you to stress test a portfolio, but that could apply to a lot of different folks. Initially, we thought we might sell this retail. They're active investors that manage maybe their own Fidelity or Schwab account.
So an individual.
That's well, Absolutely. So we didn't actually realize early on that financial advisors or that professionals would be the only audience. So early on, we actually had some retail investors. And how did we find them? We went to investment-oriented websites. Seeking Alpha specifically, and right. for those who are familiar with investing, has become very popular. And we would write blog posts or comment on others' articles and link back to charts and other interesting information on our site. So we would kind of bring some traffic in that way. But we realized pretty quickly, you know, we did get 20 or 30 retail subscribers, you know, through that process. But we realized there wasn't really a business there that we could scale, because the amount that a retail investor is willing to pay for this sort of service, you know, it's not going to necessarily be viable. Whereas you go to a professional investment advisor, this is their business. This is their livelihood. Right. So now you can get into price points that really make sense. So it was kind of a pivot process in that first year for us there to realize, okay, retail isn't it. So process of elimination, we worked on retail.
And the large ones are eliminated. The small ones are eliminated.
So exactly. We called the big banks, and we got first meetings with a wide range of companies, whether it was E-Trade, whether it was Deutsche Bank, whether it was Merrill Lynch. But you see how quickly those conversations all stalled. That's what we found. Right. So then by process of elimination, okay, well, who's left?
The boutique firms.
It's the boutique firms. And so we started... I wouldn't say knocking on doors. Most of our, you know, actually one thing we thought initially was that we need to advertise ourselves as being New York based. What we found over time is that this target audience, these boutique firms, investment advisors, they are distributed across the United States.
Right, because they left. They didn't want to be there, right? They wanted to be wherever they wanted to be.
Well, right. I mean, their client base is the doctors and dentists and attorneys and professionals in their community.
Right.
And so, so they are located all throughout the United States. And for us particularly, it turned out that the initial hotbed of interest came out of Texas and out of Kansas City. So Dallas area, Kansas City area. Some of that had to do with commodities exposure. So they were managing money. These investment advisors are managing money for folks who have a lot of, maybe they own an oil company, or maybe they are a senior officer at one. So oil prices and scenarios around that, what ifs around the Middle East, that matters to their money, not just, you know, something that's on the nightly news. So we actually started getting this interest and just sort of jumped on it.
Which is, when you were planning this out in your head, the company, you would never have said, let's start in Kansas City. That's probably going to be a hotbed for us.
Oh, right? Absolutely. And we had no idea that, you know, it would be Kansas City or Texas. And as it's turned out since then, very much distributed, such that, you know, being based out of Atlanta is not, you know, it's totally fine. It makes no difference to our client base.
And it makes sense, right?
Yeah.
And I'd love to know how the idea came about, because it's one of those products where it's, I'm assuming, very, very hard to accurately be able to forecast what's going on, which is why they're buying that service. So how did two guys get the idea that they thought this was something that they could pull off?
Right. Well, and at this point, I should sort of add, we don't necessarily attempt to forecast in the following sense. We attempt to model out what might happen with different what-if questions, but oftentimes the forecast is embedded in the question. So if you ask the question, well, what will happen to my portfolio if oil prices spike to $150 a barrel? You've gone and made an assumption about what's going to happen. Now, that our job is not still, it's not easy at that point, but we can create a model about historically what happens when oil prices spike. So now we have enough data to start to analyze. The bridge that we've built is the bridge between, okay, oil prices at $150 a barrel. What does that do to Exxon stock? What does that do to Home Depot stock? So we do historical statistical analysis to find what that relationship is between oil and the different companies, you know, in the U.S. stock market. So there is, you know, there is a lot of sophistication that went into building that. Both my co-founder and I have experience on Wall Street, and then my side, I'm sort of the product dev co-founder, and so I have a tech background as well. And so we really married that up. I should say that a lot of the techniques that we use are they're not new. Sort of the big hedge funds have been doing this, you know, since the late 80s and the 90s. And a lot of the big banks, they do it for themselves. But no one had been selling such a solution, you know, via cloud-based offering, certainly. And nobody had been selling it to this market that we found, which was these boutique advisors.
Who couldn't afford to create their own proprietary thing?
Right. I mean, there is a public company called MSCI, and they bought another public company called RiskMetrics for over $1 billion. And that firm, RiskMetrics, their solution starts at $100,000 to $200,000 per year, you know. And so that's precisely what you're talking about. They have no way of accessing this small market. They don't want to cannibalize their own offering.
Right.
So that's where we come in.
So that's exciting, huh? Yeah, like when you found like that wasn't the end of the world to land on boutique firms.
No, not at all. I mean, we found a market. We, you know, once we realized that, okay, there's some demand here. And I should add, to be more specific for your listeners, how did we find that market? Well, we were doing this process of elimination, but my co-founder and I, we didn't. The financial industry has so many layers. You know, there's so many layers in that onion that you peel back. We didn't know about all the nuances. We didn't really realize how to find these types of folks.
Right.
One of the things that we did was that we went to a financial industry tech conference called Finovate, and virtually every sort of industry has these. I mean, you've got your TechCrunch type of conferences, your general tech conferences, but if you go in and you look, if you're in the travel industry, I'm sure there's something for travel tech, you know, whatever right. It may be. So we went to this conference, and in presenting there, we started to see, okay, well, who's showing up at our little booth or kiosk afterward? Who's interested? And it turned out it was the private banking arms of little regional banks, or it was these boutique firms themselves. And so that was the folks who were in attendance that showed interest. And we realized right then, we need to make a professional product and get that launched stat and get to work.
Because they were saying they were hungry for this.
Well, that was where the demand was coming from. Right. You know, whenever you're on the sort of the trade show floor, you'll have a variety of conversations, and everybody's sort of in biz dev mode and like, oh yeah, let's have this discussion. What you're looking for, the people are like, no, I want to buy this. Do X and I will pay for it. That's, right. You know.
So that you kind of accidentally fell into it.
Well, absolutely. You know, it was a matter, and if I were to start over again, or let's say with my next startup, we might take a more disciplined approach on the front end. It took us about a year from having an alpha product or something worthy of showing, you know, an early customer, to the point where we had identified the right client base.
Right.
And I think that had we done our homework better, we might have shortened that time frame by actually doing some customer discovery instead of building a lot of product and then going to market. And so that's something that, you know, a lot of accelerators teach nowadays, and we could have benefited from.
And on the UX UI side, or on the way that the modules are put together, was there a difference to the product when you changed that audience? Was it exactly the same?
There was. In this, you know, we realized that professionals, that they want, content-wise, there was some difference. I won't say that was huge, but it was almost in how information is presented. When you look at the retail investor, let's say technically savvy, meaning they're probably doing online trading and they're looking up investment research online themselves, they were happy to have a tool that was purely online. Maybe even, you know, as we started advancing, let's go mobile, let's do that. This may be interesting for folks to hear, but we actually found ourselves going in the other direction for the professional audience. What is their expectation based on all of the other analytics tools and other tools that they've used for decades? It prints PDF reports. So we needed to literally build, you know, some nice looking reports so that they could output that and go to a meeting. Many of their meetings they still had on paper with clients. So it wasn't sufficient to have a whiz-bang UX that's on the web or on an iPad. It actually had to get back to paper and look decent on paper.
And that they used that as kind of private labeling your research?
Right, absolutely. They would put their, or they do today still, put their branding on the reports, and then they're able to present that material as part of a larger sort of pitch, you know, whether it's a prospective client they're meeting with, or even if it's an existing client, you know, when they sit down, they can kind of go through, well, this is all the work that we've done looking at your portfolio, and this is our recommendations, and here's why.
And the beauty of your product is that since it isn't really you forecasting anything, it's them taking data, then multiple competitors can use the same product for their own firm in a given market, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we haven't. I mean, occasionally we'll hear the questions like, "Oh, but so and so down the street has it." But actually, that has been, as we've started to see more adoption. So the idea of stress testing a portfolio, which incidentally the approaches that we use are virtually identical to what the Federal Reserve does with the big bank stress tests that folks may have heard of. In fact, you can run the Federal Reserve stress tests with hidden levers on your client's portfolio. So that's something that we do for advisors. But the way that works and you know the output that they get, it's something that sort of enables that client conversation and just enables them to build confidence with their clients that, oh, okay, this is why we're allocated in a certain way.
Right, because each boutique differentiates themselves in the marketplace slightly differently.
Right. They all have different different value propositions. You know, it's interesting. Anytime you introduce a new technology into, put something new out there, then there's this period of just sort of market awareness.
Right.
And as your market awareness grows, even if competitors come into the market, now we've been around since, you know, really in this the market we're in today since 2011, and recently we've seen a few competitors enter the market, and it's almost additive, it's almost helpful, because once there are three or four companies doing something, then it becomes a legitimate category. And folks feel like, oh, okay, you can shop around, and if that grows the pie, actually that's beneficial to us rather than
right, because now you can spend less time educating them, and now they're just choosing amongst competitors.
Absolutely, yeah. So we've found that to be the case, that overall awareness building is I would say it's still a challenge since we are relatively new, and particularly in the, you know, in the audience that we face. But that's what we see starting to happen now, is that barrier is coming down.
And how global do you think this offering is? I'm assuming that someone that's investing from Germany, for example, is just as interested in what's happening in the dollar as they would be here. Do you see this as a global program?
Absolutely, yeah. We actually, you know, just as an example, did a demo Monday for a gentleman from a Japanese investment bank who sits at a trading desk in London. So, you know, the possibilities are absolutely there. You know, as a small firm, we're trying to figure out how do we attack those in a way that that makes sense. And honestly, you know, I mentioned before how we've been bootstrapped to this point and haven't raised capital. But I think that as we've started to realize that, okay, the international opportunities, you know, are starting to become evident and other opportunities are becoming evident, that's when it may make sense to really go and raise capital to be able to address that, because then the opportunity sort of magnifies.
Now, I'd like to shift gears a little bit and talk about your work with the Founders Institute. Can you educate our listeners to what it is and why you made it happen here in town?
Sure, absolutely. So Founder Institute is, and actually for your listeners, fi.co is the URL for anybody who wants to go out and take a look. And they the tagline, I think, is the world's largest startup accelerator. There's a serial entrepreneur by the name of Adeo Resi out of Silicon Valley, and he started a number of companies in the 90s. The final exit was, I think, you know, over $1 billion. But, you know, so he sort of had a good track record in that era of, you know, the first wave of big.com tech, and he had a couple of companies sort of thereafter. But over the last 5 or 6 years, his primary focus has been on the Founder Institute. What his idea was is, can we globalize Silicon Valley? Can we take this model that has proven so effective in Silicon Valley of getting entrepreneurs coupled with the right capital early on into an accelerator program that helps them mold their vision and really vet their idea, do that customer discovery early on, figure out if there really is a market for their product. Can we bottle all of that up? And unlike some accelerators, so there are lots of great accelerator programs out there, you know, the Y Combinators and those sorts of accelerators, can we replicate this in city after city after city? So Founder Institute is in over 50, I mean, the numbers keep on growing. It's probably over 60 cities around the world now. Last year, so this was fall of 2013, I had the opportunity to be the co-director of the inaugural chapter of Founder Institute in Atlanta. So it was a great experience. What happened actually was that Adeo Resi, the FI founder, he had been looking at the Atlanta market for a while and had never been able to successfully put a program together here. I feel like actually in some sense it was because Atlanta had some existing resources in place.
Right.
This is prior to, let's say, Atlanta Tech Village taking off, but with the things going on at ATDC and elsewhere, other programs in Atlanta, that there was something of an ecosystem. And so finally in 2013, he felt like, okay, it's time to try to enter the, you know, Atlanta startup scene. And he went looking for potential directors. So my name came up in the hat somehow. And it was a great experience. What we were tasked to do was to get the word out about the program and to build a class of 25 would-be entrepreneurs. So these would be folks who, you know, they might have had a previous experience in entrepreneurship, but generally speaking, were probably in a corporate or professional position, but they had this dream or this vision, this itch to, you know, to build a company, and they have an idea. So where Founder Institute, you know, where would be applicants, where in the life cycle of a startup, you know, are they ideally? The answer is they have an idea, Maybe they've gotten so far as to do some initial work around that, but they don't yet have a product in the market.
And they have no customer, no product.
Yeah, they don't.
They have a napkin.
Exactly, they have a napkin. That's about where Founder Institute sort of incoming, the incoming class is expected to be. One way that it's positioned is that when you graduate from Founder Institute, at that point, it may actually be appropriate for you to apply to some of the later stage incubators like a Y Combinator or, like a Kickstarter, or not a Kickstarter, like a, some Techstars, of the other programs that are out there. So FI is for, sort of very much early on, enabling folks who are keeping their day job for the moment to make that leap through an accelerator to actually start working full time on
their
idea.
So now, say you meet somebody that's at a large firm, like a Home Depot, and they have an idea. And then they come. How do they become part of the program? Is this like an evening class? Like what actually happens?
So it is an evening class. Last year we did it every Tuesday, and I believe that this fall we'll really starting beginning of next year the schedule will be the same. Last fall we spent recruiting, and we actually ended up starting the classes essentially the first week of January, and I expect this year will be the same. So from January to roughly April, 16 weeks. Every Tuesday for roughly 2 hours. But in terms of the homework, it's actually more like a 20, maybe even 30-hour week commitment. And the reason why is the expectation is that there's no busy work in the program. Every week you're putting in 20 or 30 hours a week to building your company. That's what every week's exercise is about. So the exercises are things like if you have a B2C idea, so you want to go out and reach consumers with some consumer product idea or consumer tech idea, there 1 week your assignment will be to go out and reach 500 people and get their opinion, via an online survey or something similar. So you really have to go out and do the hard work. The great thing about it, now it's interesting, so we had an incoming group of 25 entrepreneurs.
When you told them 500... How many people quit?
Well, we had 25 come in, and the way it works is that the expected graduation rate is only around, actually, it's a little inside 50%. Mm-hmm. As it worked out for us, I think we had 12 out of 25. But that's not a bad thing.
Right.
Actually, in many ways, if you come into such a program and you realize 4 weeks in that, startups aren't for you because it's hard to go out and try to pitch to that many folks, and it's hard to... to iterate on your product idea because, a lot of coming from the product side, a lot of times engineers or product-oriented folks will have an idea that they're in love with, a product idea they're in love with, and then they try to take it to market and the market doesn't love their baby.
Right.
And they're not willing to change their baby. Well, then that's not really a startup in the sort of commercial sense.
It's a hobby.
Right, exactly. So you kind of get pushed through those lessons if you make it through all 16 weeks. And it is intended to be a rigorous program that way. There are every week you have to pitch. You do your 1 minute stump pitch, and you're graded by mentors. And so the program was very much built around having 2 to 3 mentors every week to speak to the group and also to grade their pitches.
So now they go through the thing. Are you one of the mentors as well, or you're the facilitator or organizer? What's your role exactly?
Facilitator and organizer, but mentor in the sense that, as the, folks in the class had, have questions or, things come up. And also, I did also stand in as one of the judges a few times as well. So
do you, have volunteer mentors? How does this?
Yeah, absolutely. So let me think. I think we had in total around 30 volunteer mentors.
And these are all founders?
Mostly founders, a few folks from the investment community, but the great majority are founders, and that was the intent. So we had some great folks this past year, like Rob Frohwein of Cabbage, for instance, and George Machini at Catavolt. So some great local companies and great local founders or tech company leaders.
Did they have to commit for the full 16 weeks, or they popped in and popped out when you needed them?
Well, no, the way because we, so the reason to have 30 mentors is that each one pops in for a week or two. Uh-huh. And so they have an opportunity to participate, just literally for a few hours of their time. If they want to participate multiple weeks, that's possible as well, but not a huge load on the mentors, at the same time exposing the students in the class to a wide range of of different founders and their experiences.
And do they have to be tech companies?
Meaning the mentors participants?
The students that are going through.
They have to be high growth companies. So the sort of cutoff, if you will, that's established is your idea scalable, you know, and in the sense that it doesn't require a linear ramp in human resources in particular. So I think that the idea there is that consulting and many other businesses are great businesses, but they don't have the tendency to be venture backed or investable businesses because of that need to add HR so heavily along with growth.
So venture backed is one of the criteria?
Or the potential to be. So, there's no expectation that you take outside funding, but the hope is that it's, like Silicon Valley, this idea of globalizing Silicon Valley, that the idea that you're working on is one that that has that sort of hope, desired growth trajectory.
That hockey stick growth.
Exactly.
So it isn't necessarily, it could be a healthcare or biotech, I guess, would be some health related in that, but not like a doctor's office.
Sure, exactly. So I think that's a good differentiation. It could be, and we did have folks for, here's a concrete example. There was one student in the class this past year who had an idea around a remote DBA, a cloud-based sort of DBA or database administrator service. And, we thought, we kind of told him, well, that's interesting, but you are going to run into these challenges around scalability. Is there an idea here that you can kind of take and that we can pull from this, that we could really, that you could build a more scalable, maybe more product-oriented business around? And what he came up with was he sort of pulled out some of the key features of what he was wanting to provide and came up with a cloud-based software service around that, around data encryption and other services for remotely managed databases, with the add-on of consulting services for those who needed it, so that it's not purely a consulting play and isn't like bound to kind of that traditional consulting growth path.
Now, is the Founder Institute, is that you pay a fee to participate, or does Founder Institute take a piece of this? What's the relationship between Founder Institute and the companies?
Good question. So there is a tuition, which I believe was around $950 for the class. In addition, there is an expectation that if you do start the company, and you go to market, I believe it's 3.5% of equity goes to the Founder Institute. Now, that's not dissimilar from many other accelerators that that are in operation. But one interesting feature that I think is unique to Founder Institute, at least as I've heard, is that 3.5%, where does that go? 1/3 of it actually goes to your classmates.
That participate in that?
In that chapter. And so, roughly 1% is, broken up and distributed to your other classmates and vice versa. So you have a small stake in the success of all of your peers. And so that's kind of a nice feature. And then the rest of it goes out to the Founder Institute. And actually the mentors are compensated with a small fraction as well.
Ed, you had a question?
Yes. So you asked earlier, where are we in the space? So what we do, we partner, we like to think that we're the largest because we are in 140 city. We have cross relations, cross-border relations with many, many investors, real investors. I'll show you in a little while. We have Google Ventures is in our portfolio, NEA is in our portfolio, and we have over 100 Fortune 500 companies that our approach is this: disruptive startups pay zero, and we bring them in, and then we mentor them at no charge. We introduce them to companies that will also do what we call the 180 deal, right? And then so they don't have to get a term sheet, which means they're not diluted. And then after that, they get to grow. Those that have an idea but it's not on a napkin or do not have a business case, those we really assist. That's the reason why we're so busy. We assist at no charge, if they're good. And then we put them into the specific vertical. Those that do not have anything, then we have mentors. We call, how is that we get mentors? They have to be repeat or 3P. If they're not within online, they can answer the questions of those individuals that want to start up, and then as they receive the confidence and the trust of others, then they can become part of the mentorship. And but we want to make sure that those that come in and they're doing providing services to those that we do not charge, they can charge, so that we show them that we want to grow and not basically become, you know, on day one a for-profit organization.
Right. Yeah, you're doing something different in the marketplace.
Right.
But
Praveen, I think that's thank you for sharing a little bit more about what you're doing. And I do like the approach of sometimes when you're in those incubators, there's a great sense of kind of camaraderie, and there's a sense where you're trying to help each other sort out your marketing plan and various other bits. And what I like is that idea, even if it is token, it gets everyone to thinking, well, actually, let's keep this conversation going, let's keep building people. And so actually, it's the first time I've heard of that 1%, and where it may be token, I think it's actually hopefully doing more than just the 1%. It actually gets people into the mindset, which is the mm-hmm. key of these people, you know, people that you should be investing in if there's something you can do for them in the future. I think that's a very clever way of doing it.
Right, and the group is all over the globe now, right?
Right, and I believe the first chapter from Silicon Valley or San Francisco, one of those initial chapters, has actually had enough exits that they had some payouts, and they were not small. Seeing the way that that startup valuations have been, in the Valley with some of the particularly the B2C companies, so they were in the neighborhood of $100,000 per, you know. And so this is just for your fractional share of one or two of the companies that right. have performed in your cohort. But I should distinguish, actually, Ed, that was helpful to help distinguish how different programs are structured. Founder Institute is not technically a nonprofit, nor does it pretend to be. It does because at the end of the day, Founder Institute is taking a small fraction of each of the companies that are participating, and their goal is for those investments to be successful.
Right.
So that is a way in which they are invested in all of these companies, and they'd like to continue to grow it as successes happen, as exits occur, to continue to expand. And so it is being run as a for-profit venture.
Right. And there's a place in this market for everybody.
Yeah.
I mean,
yes.
Absolutely.
Now, if somebody wants to learn more, where should they go for Founders Institute?
So fi.co, fi.co is the URL, and you'll see Atlanta listed there, and can get the date or the information on dates for the upcoming chapter and so on.
And how has your involvement with the Founders Institute impacted your day job at the Hidden Levers?
Well, good question. I should say that it was busy, and due to my day job, you know, being co-founder of a startup and actually just having a new addition to our family recently, I've actually stepped back from Founder Institute for this fall. And so we've got a couple new co-directors who are going to be leading Atlanta for the upcoming chapter. And but no, it's a great program that I hope to get back to once I'm able to sleep through the night again.
And if somebody wanted to learn more about Hidden Levers website?
Hiddenlevers.com, we say, because when we hear it, we've got to use the British pronunciation there, because when we say Hidden Levers and we call someone up, they're like, Hidden Levers? Which is our backup business idea if this doesn't work out.
Yeah, the hits might be different.
Yeah. Right. James, you say the URL.
It's hiddenlevers.com.
Exactly. Thank you.
See, that'll class it up.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all for being part of the show today. This show is brought to you by our friends at Band of Coders, and without their generous underwriting of it, it would not be here. So thank you, James, for representing Band of Coders today.
No, a pleasure. Have a lovely week.
All right. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Technology Leaders.
Atlanta Technology Leaders is brought to you by Band of Coders. Band of Coders is a company of talented software developers who energize clients' projects and their development teams.